Nobody does it better than Regent Seven Seas Cruises. Enjoy all-inclusive, unrivaled luxury with unlimited shore excursions, indulgent cuisine, personalized service, and more aboard spacious all-suite ships. Visit rssc.com to experience the unrivaled.
On the Pilot TV podcast this week, we're joining a sex cult in Sky Documentary's The Vow, heading to a parallel world in Series 2 of the BBC's His Dark Materials, and finally getting to find out what Baby Yoda's been up to over the past year in the triumphant return of The Mandalorian on Disney+. I have spoken. I'm James Dyer, and welcome to the Pilot TV podcast, specifically the last Pilot TV podcast before the impending US election. So, depending on how that goes, we may or may not be back, depending on whether there's a podcast studio on whatever planet we're forced to relocate to. And to the listener from Florida who left us a one-star rating this week because of our Trump bashing and quote-unquote woke nonsense, despite saying they liked the show, all I can say is, I'm sorry, but the man is an absolute monster and there's really no getting around it. Although I will say that you declaring you'll upgrade your one-star to a five-star review if we agree to change our ways regarding the MAGA masses is arguably the most on-brand Trump thing ever conceived. Anyway, joining me on the Trump-thumping TV podcast are two Biden bros of no small renown, to wit, notorious snowflake cuck Mr. Boyd Hilton and feminist libtard Terry White. How are you both?
Oh, that's the nicest thing you've ever said about me.
I like the way you pronounce it, MAGA.
What would you have called it? It's like, yeah, but it'd be MAGA if I was American.
Yeah,
one is one
like
is not
Margo.
American
like,
or from the North.
Who's Margo? What's this Margo movement? Margo. Like Margo from Margo. The Good Life.
Yeah, Margo Masses.
How do you say Arga, James, as in the cooker? That's a middle class thing.
I mean, I'm not middle class enough to have an Arga, but it would be an Arga, not an Aga.
Aga.
Aga, no, that doesn't work at all.
Yeah, but it gives it kind of a weird sheen of respectability to say MAGA. Do you know what I mean? It feels
exactly
like MAGA. MAGA is the hard edge.
Yeah. I'm wearing a MAGA hat. Doesn't sound the same.
MAGA hat. Darling, darling, it's a MAGA hat. Yes. Okay, I got a Borat hat, actually, that said Make America Nice Again, which I rather enjoyed. But at a distance, it just looks like a MAGA hat, so I'm never going to wear it. But speaking of the MAGA masses, Terry, it is time for the latest segment that we've introduced to the podcast, Terry's Update on the West Wing. For all of you out there who are Trump supporters, then you're probably not going to enjoy this bit, but carry on, Terry.
Oh my God. So I watched another, how many episodes? 10 episodes this week, just to kind of continue my obsession. I've realized that my life is basically broken into chunks of time, and those chunks of time are work, look after my son, watch The West Wing. The final two have now met in that me and my son watch The West Wing together twice a day. So in the morning, when we get up before he has his breakfast, and then in the evening after he's had his tea. He enjoys it as much as I do. And do you know what? I've been thinking a little bit more about this week about why I like it so much. And do you know what I really respect is the kind of narrative ingenuity and innovation and effort put into each episode. So even, you know, thinking about 20 hours in LA, the way that was structured, take out the trash day. There's the take the Sabbath day when there's the prisoner who's due to be sentenced on death row. Each one has this incredible structure of its own. That means it stands alone. It's not just like another episode of another West Wing. It's each one feels special and unique in its own way. And in these 10 episodes, I've gone up to essentially mandatory minimums.
Mm.
So the last two I've just watched are very, very important, as we know, because I watched 6 meetings before lunch, which included, as we know, the moment that a lot of people shouted at me when I first started watching this, and I had no idea what they were talking about. And then it was Alice and Janney doing CJ Does the Jackal. Holy shit. What did I just watch? I did rewind it and watch it multiple times because holy shit, what did I just watch? But then everybody was saying, there was a guy on Twitter saying, oh my God, well, the next episode, just prepare yourself. which is Let Bartlett Be Bartlett. And oh my God, like that episode, the end, I was in tears at the rousing end. I serve at the pleasure of the president. Oh my God, him getting, you know, this fire in his belly, Leo being let off the leash, then really kind of going for it. And I tell you what, I do see what people mean, because there are moments where I was like, you're all so smug, and I'm not even sure you're that experienced. And actually looking at you in a room, you're really young, and you do think you're geniuses, and you do think you're political kind of like heavyweights when arguably you're not. But oh my God, I love them all. And what I loved about Let Bartlett Be Bartlett is the end when they're all with Leo and they all go round and say it in turn. And you know what? It really made me miss the Empire Office, because that sense of...
Because we're just like that.
No, that
let Terry be Terry. I serve at the pleasure of the editor.
Well, that sense of people being together and you coming in and you walk, you know, the only thing you have in common with these people, to paraphrase The Office, is that you walk on the same piece of carpet for, you know, 8, 10, 12, whatever it is, hours a day. And you are brought together by a common good and a common passion and a common purpose. And if we may not be, you know, in the White House making decisions about the future of America, but it made me miss being in a place with people where we were all together around a shared passion and a shared belief system and a shared love. And it made me really emotional, but it was interesting, because, you know, what is it? Episode 19 of what, 22? By the way, really, really loads of episodes per series. But and I wasn't expecting this seismic episode, this significant monumental episode, just to drop at episode 19. It's not an opener, it's not a finale, but it's this incredible new kind of fresh fire and air being breathed into this show that I've just already given 18 hours of my life over to. In essence, it continues, and I was desperate to get to the end of season one for them before this podcast, but I couldn't, unfortunately, because I had to sleep. But magnificent. And there are things I'm noticing all the time, like Mandy, I'm becoming, you know, a little bit unsure of Mandy. I don't feel like her character's really been built out that well yet. We've obviously had the debacle with the memo she wrote about how you destroyed that specific administration. She's got these hard edges, and I think I said last week, I don't mind them, because I think that's how you'd be as a woman in that environment. But I think I might need a little bit more substance to Mandy's character to start to give a shit about her in a significant way. But I couldn't be more in love with the rest of them, like CJ and Sam, and obviously we talked about Toby last week, but Leo, the bloody, you know, alcohol and pill addiction, that whole, the way they came together for him for that, their loyalty and love, and the president's got multiple sclerosis, and the first lady is like trying to help him hide it, and you know, like... his political enemies are just going to use it as a stick to beat him with when they find out, which of course they'll find out, because that's how it works. Oh, God, it's just, oh, I mean, and Josh, right? Oh, God, I hate him and I love him and I feel like Donna sometimes, and like sometimes I think you're Josh and I'm Donna, and then sometimes I think I'm Josh and you're Donna. Like, I don't know. Like, it's just magical. Every minute is magical, and I can't believe I didn't have this in my life before. It's wonderful. Oh.
Does that make me Toby or...
you are totally, yeah, Toby.
Totally,
no,
Toby.
No, you're Toby.
Yeah.
You're totally Toby.
Yeah.
Yeah. I always thought that it would be me who would cause people to stop listening to this podcast by banging on about the West Wing. But actually, surprise of all things, it's actually not. Boyd, how's your Battlestar Galactica rewatch going?
Oh, it stopped.
What do you mean it stopped?
I'm a busy man. I need to do a Terry and parcel out, like, you know, two episodes a day, but I haven't got a small baby to bring up. So it's probably, I think probably that enables the structure, doesn't it, to some extent?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Although I have got a Baby Yoda plush doll, so maybe that can
not
pretend.
Talk about, yeah, the sorry. Fact that they sent you a Baby Yoda plush and I, as yet, remain without one, but
as yet, I'm sure
thank
you'll
Disney.
Get one. I'm sure you'll get one. Anyway, no, I haven't been watching Battlestar Galactica. I will go back to it. I got up to about season four, but What I've been watching, which I guess is what you're moving on to subtly, before this turns into the other West Wing podcast, the other West Wing Weekly podcast, which is fine, which is great. I've caught up with The Queen's Gambit, which was
hoping you'd have watched that.
Yeah. This was the Netflix miniseries that we didn't have time to. It arrived in a very busy week, and to be honest, Netflix didn't.
Also,
really
we didn't get episodes, did we? So
particularly. Well, I mean, it may not be their fault. I don't know. It's one of those things. It was very late in the day that they alerted people to the fact that it was arriving late October or wherever. But it's really fucking good. Is the bottom line. It does star Anya Taylor-Joy, who's always incredible. She's fucking brilliant as Beth Harmon, who is a real life chess phenomenon in the 50s and 60s. The drama opens in classic style in 1967, which is as far as it goes, and when she's about to take part in a huge chess event, and then it flashes back to her childhood when she becomes an orphan, where the mother's involved in a car crash and she's sent to this orphanage for young girls where they feed them kind of drugs to keep them kind of docile, and that launches a lifelong issue with drugs and various addictions that she has going through her life, while she becomes this incredible chess prodigy when she's like 9-10 years old, and when she meets Bill Camp, the brilliant Bill Camp from The Night Of. He played the lawyer in The Night Of. I don't know if you remember, he's phenomenal. The detective. And he is the chess playing person who befriends her, like in the basement of the children's home, and he teaches her to play chess. And he's phenomenal. And it's seven episodes. It's very tightly, the narrative is very tight. It's not too long. It's got a real snap to it. The storytelling is beautiful to look at. It's got some occasional cheesy moments, like she imagines the chess. She kind of looks up into the ceiling and imagines playing chess, kind of in a weird that with their way of visualizing her obsession with chess. It's slightly clunky, I thought, but it's really, really a really quality piece of work. And it's one of those things. If this had been on, you know, BBC One on Sunday nights for 7 weeks, it would be a huge, huge thing for them, and everyone would be obsessed with it. It's just another really good Netflix show, and it's a limited series, so it's not like there's no issue of it being cancelled. It is just a really, really good show.
So that's
The Queen's Gambit. And I wanted to quickly mention Max, which is the other show that we didn't have time for last week, which is O.T. Fagbenley's comedy, which was originally going to air on E4 back in the spring, then they took it off air, and now it's on Channel 4 every Thursday, and it's really outrageous. It's got a little bit of Michaela Cole quality to it, and that more like in the chewing gum days, when she did very bold, like almost cartoony, colourful visuals matched to very, very outrageous kind of dealings with sexuality and sex itself. And there's loads of that in it. And OT is really funny as a massive bell end, huge, gigantic ex-boy band bell end. And Christopher Maloney, as I mentioned last week, is in it, who's brilliant as this ridiculous American manager. And in episode two, there's an amazing threesome scene with OT, Christopher Maloney, and his crazy wife, who's a bit like Melania Trump.
Well, you know how I feel about unrealistic threesomes, Boyd.
I know. This is a realistic threesome.
This is a realistic threesome. Okay, fine. Well, that's absolutely fine. What have I been watching this week? I have finished season one of Counterpart. Now, I talked a bit about this last week. Counterpart, of course, being the show where J.K. Simmons plays himself and, of course, himself in two parallel dimensions which cross over, obviously, in Berlin. And there's a building where you can cross over from one dimension to the other. And so there's two versions of him in it. One, you know, sort of assuming civilian, and the other one a hardcore spy. It's very, very different. But this show is so fucking good. Like, I'm watching it, and the more I'm watching it, I was like, this isn't just, I'm quite enjoying this, it's a bit trashy. This is genuinely like A-grade, top-level quality television. I cannot believe there are only two seasons of this, unless it, you know, wraps up perfectly, and that's the way, you know, who knows. I'm only finished season one, haven't got season two yet, but it's so, so good. So many good people in it. Harry Lloyd is excellent in this. Nazanin Boniardi, Nicholas Pinnock's in it. It's just really, really good cast. But it's incredibly sort of dense spy craft. There's lots going on, you know, working out who's who. And sometimes, you know, it's quite difficult to work out which side you're on. They actually do it very well, because they do it all through characterization. Because so often with this kind of show, you'd think they'd use like a different lens filter, you know, to show one reality and the other, just like a visual cue to let you know, like in shorthand, where you are. And this doesn't really do that. It's just a case of remembering, you know, how characters are behaving. And they do a thing where you tend to get different characters on each side. But really, really good espionage thriller with a little bit of a sci-fi dystopian twist. It also features a kind of a foreshadowing of the pandemic, because on one of the realities, there's been a deadly swine flu outbreak. And so everyone wears masks all the time and they're all washing their hands and sterilizing them in these UV lights. And obviously, that's our normal now. So it doesn't look as weird as I guess it did when the show first came out. But prescient and extremely good counterpart. I highly recommend it. I've also been watching the new season of a very exciting show, but I'm not allowed to talk about it. But I've done a lot of that. So that's me being a smug twat. So,
my God, you're one of those insufferable dicks.
Yes, I'm one of those insufferable dicks. Funnily normally, enough. Boyd gets to be the insufferable dick with these things, but it's me in this instance. Right. Terry, I'm assuming you have watched nothing but The West Wing. So,
yeah, I mean, The West Wing.
Yeah. Let's move on now to this week's listener question, which comes from George at Gorge, and who has, you know, adhered to the new rules of this question and says, for the no Buffy / West Wing / Friends question challenge, what's the best and worst follow-up project to a major hit show, e.g. Newsroom after West Wing equals bad, Leftovers after Lost equals good? I mean, two things. One, you've actually mentioned The West Wing in the question, which rather defeats the object. And also, The Newsroom, I think you find, was not the show he did after The West Wing. It was, in fact, Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, which is equally flawed, but I really like it. Anyway, who wants to start?
Yeah, I was going to say that.
I think you'll find.
Yeah, I think you'll find he's right, though, that Studio 60, which I wanted to love, I absolutely wanted to love, and I actually interviewed him for that on the Edinburgh TV Festival. Yeah, have I told you this story? Yeah, via satellite in front of 300 people, and I had to interview him on a big screen, and it was quite stressful, and he was really lovely, to be fair, and it was all about Studio 60. And I kind of enjoyed it to start with, but it just didn't sustain. There was something about it. Not sustain a kind of big long season, I didn't think.
There were networks wranglings, which I think partly caused it to, they wanted it to be something different, and the show kind of did go downhill in the second half of that one season. Yeah. But I think also it came out the same year as 30 Rock, which was, you know, on the face of it, a slightly similar subject matter. Also, I think everyone's interested in a kind of, you know, workplace drama about politics in the White House. That's inherently interesting. You know, it's a bit inside baseball to go behind the scenes of creating a variety TV show. It's maybe not as accessible, but it's still got great writing. It's still good.
Not only that, but to kind of have the same level of self-importance about creating this sketch show as you would about changing the world of politics in the West Wing. It had the same kind of, you know, everything's like ratcheted up to the max, wasn't it? It was like, this is all really, really important. Well, it's not really. I mean, you know, and in fact, that's why 30 Rock felt the better tone to deal with. The making of a sketch show dealt with in ludicrously stupid, silly sitcom terms.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I also, it's one of these things, especially in that first episode, like, talk about setting yourself up for a fall, where the whole episode is about trying to write the best episode of television ever, and then you kind of have to show it.
Yes.
So you're really building up, like, this had better be the best thing ever, because you're writing it, and you've said it's going to be. But yeah, I did enjoy it. I thought it was funny, and it dealt with a lot of the same themes, actually, that it deals with on The West Wing as well. You know, the fact that the Sarah Paulson's character is kind of an evangelical Christian, and that becomes a kind of source of, you know, of some of the drama. Timothy Busfeld in it. You know, all the great Sorkin players. But yeah, I like it a lot.
I would like to say, Joey, you thought you were going to get away with Friends?
Oh, yes.
Absolutely not. So I think what we can all agree is that Joey is literally one of the worst TV shows ever made. And also, by that very nature, one of the worst kind of, what are we calling them, spin-offs?
Follow-ups.
Or, you know, follow-ups. Joey goes to LA, so he's got none of the other friends. And let's be honest, which of those friends could actually hold their own sitcom is a very good question, because it's the tapestry of the different characters and their dynamic and all of that that actually makes Friends so successful. Just Joey all the time is not funny. Like, that's just the reality. It was not funny. Moving to LA, tapping into all that kind of, you know, the superficiality of the acting world and how unreal. No.
It was absolutely terrible, wasn't it? And I remember the funny thing about it was in this country, it was Channel 5, wasn't it? And they were so excited about it, because at that point, you know, it was a fairly new young channel. They didn't really have any hits particularly. I don't think anyone was that. And they were like, this is going to be the making of us. We've got the rights to fucking Joey. And it was absolute shit.
No.
It was awful.
Oh, yeah. Dear. Yeah, that was pretty bad. But Boyd, I'm sure that you, I mean, he mentions The Leftovers. That's a pretty fucking good shout, isn't it?
100%. Not only is Damon Lindelof went from Lost to The Leftovers, which was incredible. Then he went to Watchmen.
Yeah.
So he's done a double masterpiece situation after Lost. And I have my issues with Lost, particularly the final season and everything. But, I mean, there's no denying it was a game-changing... It changed the face of particularly network television, Lost. It was absolutely incredible. That year when Lost and Desperate Housewives came out and were like, it was a whole new world on ABC. Incredible boldness right there. Their creative... the creative freedom they gave to these shows with huge budgets and everything. That was an unbelievable time. But then for Damon Lindelof to then come up with The Leftovers, absolutely incredible. And I do think The Leftovers is as I've said many times, is in the top five, top 10 shows of all time.
Mm. Yeah, 100%. I agree with you. What about bad ones? What have you got for bad ones?
Oh, loads of them. Baywatch Nights.
Oh, Baywatch Nights. I mean, Baywatch was hardly a fucking masterpiece, was it? But yeah, Baywatch Nights.
Baywatch had a purpose and had an audience and never quite got the idea of setting it around solving mysteries at night. It's, but there you go.
Baywatch meets the X-Files was not kind of what people had in mind. No. It went a bit supernatural, didn't it?
Yes. Yes, it did. It went absolutely deranged. And I would also mention The Carrie Diaries, which were obviously, it was next one after Sex and the City and was Carrie's younger life as a girl, because actually the interesting thing about Carrie's character in Sex and the City is you know very little about her background, where she's from, her parents. None of that is actually, weirdly, for a show that ran for so many years, delved into. And then which really is quite exciting, because the world you can create is pretty much anything apart from it was kind of very light and very frothy and short on laughs, and became, I think, mainly about shoes, which people always thought Sex and the City was about, but it actually wasn't about shoes. It was about so much more than that. And the shoes were the Trojan horse in which the issues of the day were taken to task. So that was another poor one. I only have poor ones, I've got to be frank.
Wow.
And then Darren Star also, of course, went on to create Emily in Paris, which is about shoes, effectively.
Yes, yes. There is no Trojan horse.
There's no Trojan horse. He's gone literal. There, no. Yes. Yeah, I think you've done that. It's easier to do good ones, I think. But
I mean, there are a bunch of different ones. Like David Milch went from NYPD Blue to Deadwood, and both of those are pretty iconic, aren't they? You know, you can't really beat that. Mm.
But hang on. You can't just do the next shows they did.
I mean, isn't that what the question is?
No. So, like, Joey is a character from Friends. Oh, no. That's a follow-up.
Oh, no, he means follow-up projects, like the next project not related projects.
Your answer is better and more in a way, but it's a limited field,
so it's
isn't it?
Yeah,
it's literally like what showrunners did next. Yes, yes.
Yeah, not
that isn't the question. The question is follow-up shows.
The examples he used were West Wing Newsroom, Lost Leftovers. Those are literally the examples in the question.
That's a rubbish question.
Oh, sorry. George,
I think you'll find.
Joey's turned on you.
I think you'll find. Literally just, which show did they do next? Oh, bloody hell, let's get the IMDb out. It's way more interesting to do follow-up shows.
Wow.
That's why I was banging on about Joey so much.
Oh, God.
I lost us the Trump supporter. You've now lost us George. This is terrible.
Well, in answer to that question, to Terry's version of the question then, Frasier falling off from Cheers is fucking amazing as well.
Yeah, that's a good challenge.
That's probably the best example.
That is a good challenge.
The total triumph,
yeah. Question.
Your very good question.
Okay, well, to answer the actual question, I don't know, like Kurt Sutter went from Sons of Anarchy to The Bastard Executioner, which was an unfortunate misstep for him. Although he did kind of bring it back to an extent with Mines before he got fired. Vince Gilligan went from Breaking Bad to Battle Creek, that slightly odd procedural show, which didn't last very long.
But then he went to Better Call Saul, which is a
game. Sorry, but this question is flawed. I'll tell you why else this question is flawed. Because there's a belief here that it's like, oh, I've done this thing, and then what thing am I going to choose next? What makes sense in my career based on what I've just done? Most people have signed on for the next two shows before that show has even aired. So it's just by the luck of the gods, whatever they do after the big success, right? It's like there's no rhyme or reason or rhythm to this question. This question is nonsense.
I think what you mean to say, Terry, is you were disgusted when Joss Whedon went from Buffy the Vampire Slayer to The Dollhouse, which was nowhere near as good.
My point being that the really boring realities of making TV is that you don't sit there, have a hit and go, ooh, this is going to open loads of new doors for me now. What that means is you're going to get to make a good show in 2 years' time, not that the next thing you do in 3 months is going to be good. Anyway.
Well,
I mean, it's a fair point. It's
sorry,
a fair point.
Destroy the question, but...
You have destroyed the question, effectively. I've got a question, though, for James, which is the Lone Gunman, right, which was the follow-on from
the spin-off thing, the Terry version of this question, yes,
the X-Files. I only remember ever watching one episode of that, but was it any good? What I would say is
rather than latch onto the Lone Gunman, I would instead latch onto Millennium, which Chris Carter did while the X-Files were still on. Yeah. And in fact, there was a crossover episode. Millennium, I thought, was fucking great. I do not know if I banshee'd it or not. I will check the document. If I haven't, I will do it at some later point. But Millennium was Lance Henriksen, this guy, slightly psychic guy, who consulted with this group called the Millennium Group. And it was Terry O'Quinn as kind of Peter Watts, who was kind of the sort of figurehead of that he dealt with. And the Millennium Group would sort of have him as a consultant, and he would consult with law enforcement on, it started off as sort of serial killer stuff. There was supernatural stuff in there as well, but it was fucking dark. It was really, really bleak, and a great theme tune as well. But there were only, I want to say, 3 seasons of it. But it was one of these things where it was hinged around the fact that as we drew closer to the millennium, things were going to get more and more crazy. But of course, by that very nature, you have a built-in expiration for this show. And so they tried to introduce this concept of, oh, actually, that's not the real millennium. And they had two factions, the owls and the roosters. And the roosters were saying that 2000 was the millennium, and the owls were saying, actually, the real millennium is further on. And it became very confusing. It became utter nonsense, and it died on its ass. But it was really good. Lance Henriksen was great. And I would say that, you know, I enjoyed that as much as The X-Files when it was first on. I thought it was great. So, yeah. But no, didn't enjoy the Lone Gunman.
By the way, I think you'll find that Vince Gilligan's follow-on from Breaking Bad was Better Call Saul, not Battle Creek. Better Call Saul was on air before Battle Creek, quite rightly. And Better Call Saul is the supreme example answer to the question.
I'll let you off.
It is possibly even better than Breaking Bad.
And I've said this many times, at some point, possibly when it's over, I will sit down and watch all of Better Call Saul. But I watched the whole of season one of Better Call Saul and enjoyed it, but wasn't sucked in. Like, it didn't grip me.
Yeah. No, it gets tremendously brilliant kind of seasons two and three kind of, and then becomes one of the best things ever, seasons 4 and 5.
I will guess that. But you're right, that's a good one. And another bad one I will mention is Bo Willimon, obviously House of Cards 2, the first, sitting in boardrooms, the series, which was the least exciting Martian series I've ever seen. Right,
that was a blow,
sorry, George, for Terry liberally urinating all over your question. I hope you are not mortally offended by that. If you would like your question destroyed by Terry on the Pilot TV podcast, then feel free to send it to me on social media or to the official Pilot TV podcast Twitter account at Pilot TV Pod via direct message. Shall we move on now to this week's news? And we begin with news that Ted Lasso has got a season 3, even though we haven't seen season 2 yet. So Jason Sudeikis' charms, lost on absolutely no one except for Terry White, seem to have landed him a third season. Terry, are you psyched for this? Are you stoked?
No.
No. No, you're not.
This would be the new West Wing, honestly. When you start watching this show,
you'll be like
in about 3 years' time.
I can't believe I didn't have Ted Lasso in my life.
God. Yes. Are you kidding me?
3 years' time.
American unfunny guy comes to the UK.
It's brilliant. It's brilliant. Emily Nussbaum, the greatest TV critic in the world on the New Coast, just discovered it this week. I was so excited. And she's like, oh yeah, it's really fucking good.
I don't agree with all of her opinions normally.
I'm just saying. You don't have to agree with her opinions. I'm just saying. I'm just trying to think of ways of encouraging you to.
It's never going to happen.
But anyway, I'll tell you what. So the Crown trailer dropped this week and it's amazing. I think it is the best Crown trailer ever. It's kind of half Thatcher and half Diana. So it opens with narration by Gillian Anderson, who, oh my God, she has totally nailed Thatcher's voice and presence and poise. And there's this interesting tension between her and the Queen. And then it's like a trailer of two halves. And then you get Diana being introduced and the whole kind of drama with Charles playing out. It's a jam-packed trailer and it's right. We're really getting to the juicy stuff now, thinking about dramas and scandals and things in our lifetime that we all remember happening. It looks incredible. I can't wait to see it. I was kind of like meh a little bit about The Crown because I found the last season quite mixed, After having seen that trailer, I am fully in and ready and raring to go.
Gillian Anderson, that is going to be, you know, an award-winning thing, I predict. Just from the trailer. She embodies Thatch. And I think, and you're right, that kind of, that tension between the Queen and Thatcher was just famously a thing at the time. I remember living through that. Our whole idea is fascinating. These two gargantuan women running the country. That is going to be incredible. But I think the harder job, I think it's very interesting to see the Diana elements to it as well, because that's such a hard job, isn't it, playing Diana? You know, we've seen some terrible films and miniseries which have just
Naomi
been...
Naomi Watts, you are still laughing at them.
Oh my God, it was fucking dreadful. So I think Emma Corrin's got the harder job, really, because Diana's such a, it's just a, such a difficult thing to capture. That, you know, she's got that famous look, that kind of, you know, with the hair and the look, the kind of doe eyes and everything. But to make it, I don't know, to not slip into cliche about that, it's going to be hard. But and the other interesting thing about it is, of course, that Peter Morgan's already covered a lot of this in the film The Queen, which is going to be interesting how he deals with the fact that he's dealt with half of this already in a way.
Is it the biggest problem with Diana that she was and remains one of the most photographed and filmed women? So apart from a Kardashian, you know, nobody got the wall-to-wall coverage that Diana got. So how she looked, especially, I think, is imprinted on our brains. I think when she died, they said she was the most photographed woman in history. And so we all have this very set view of what Diana looked like, how she moved. And there's definitely kind of a, for me, in the trailer, dramatically excited me. But there's definitely a bit of a hurdle to get over, I think, for Emma Corrin in terms of how much she looks like her. And it's difficult, right? Because it isn't about, that isn't how you cast people. Oh, she looks a lot like Diana. But with Gillian Anderson, there's something in the way she iterates that character on screen when it comes to Thatcher, where you feel like she is Thatcher. And I wasn't quite getting the same sense with Emma Corrin, but it'll be interesting
think of that as a small trailer of next week's show, when we will in fact be reviewing The Crown properly. Now explain to me, so it's Emma Corrin, so when are we seeing Elizabeth Debicki as Diana? When's that happening?
Season five,
the season after.
We're in a year's time, so she will
grow.
That was the end of Diana's life, right? So we meet her here. Right. She's a teenager.
I see.
So when she met Charles, she was what?
Yeah, that's right. 1920.
And so you meet the teenage Diana, who was very different. She did a nanny, quite innocent, really not very worldly wise. Those early days of the marriage, and the woman that Diana was when she died, when she was what, 37, 38, her mother had kind of been through the ringer with the royal family, had gone out on her own, you know, was spoken of in very different terms, manipulating the press and being a very different kind of character. I think it makes sense almost to have those two different actresses tackling those two different versions of her, the girl and then the woman she became.
Who is 4 feet taller than the girl that she was. Interesting. And she certainly grows up in every conceivable sense. Yes, this will be interesting because I don't watch The Crown. I think we've reviewed it on here and I may have watched an episode to review it. I haven't watched it since. I think I watched the first episode of season one. I watched whatever reviewed last time. So I will be jumping in cold. Am I going to be fine? Is it going to be good?
Of course you're going to be fine.
Do I need to find out what happened? Like,
no, it's not like fucking Battlestar Galactica.
Who's the Cylon boy? Tell me who the Cylons are. Just bring me up to speed. Well,
Prince Philip.
There's no canon, don't worry.
Right, no, I don't need to consult the official Crown canon. Fine, okay. Well, we'll look forward to that next week when we have seen the new season of The Crown. But you know what we won't see a new season of? Brave New World, because that has been cancelled after one season. And I am unshocked by this development, if I'm honest with you. I did not like it particularly.
Deeply unshocked.
But one thing I am a little upset about is I don't think we're getting any more Mindhunters either. David Fincher has essentially said that that's probably not going to happen. It's not so much been cancelled, except I think it takes an awful lot to do and he doesn't have the time to do it and maybe seems to have lost interest a touch. Obviously, he's been making Mank.
I mean, I could never... Yeah, I love Mindhunter, but I could never work out how he would... I mean, he hasn't done a film for 4 or 5 years, to be fair.
Yeah.
But... Yeah, it's he's so meticulous, isn't he? Like, and he doesn't direct all of it, but he directs some of it and works on it, you know, very closely. I could never work out how he was going to find time to do a recurring show like that year after year anyway, and clearly he's not going to.
Well, yeah, so, fair enough. Said he doesn't think he has it in him, but also I think they probably wanted to do it slightly cheaper because it's a very expensive show, and I don't think it has that many viewers, so...
When it comes to budgets, because that's what happened with Utopia. He left Utopia because he couldn't agree the budget, and they wanted to. And he's resilient when it comes to that, and uncompromising.
Yeah, fair enough. Mean, you say that, but like Dennis Kelly managed to make Utopia for like 50p in a packet of crisps, and it's amazing. And then, of course, we got the version that Gillian Flynn did, and it was not. So, you know, money isn't everything. Money isn't everything.
Did we see words, James?
Yes. Thank you, boy. Thank you, boy. That's the Yoda in me. In lieu of an actual plush baby Yoda, which they have not sent me, I'm giving you Yoda wisdom instead.
Oh, my God. I can't believe you just pulled them out for not sending you
a
freebie.
I am bitter that I have not been sent a baby Yoda and Boyd has. Like, yeah. This is a slight I will not get over.
So spoilt.
Speaking of Disney, did you see Oscar Isaac has maybe been linked with Moon Knight, the Moon Knight series?
Yeah.
Boy's
what is
like,
that series?
Yeah, I don't care.
I did, but I can't remember what the series is.
Moon Knight. It's Moon Knight. Moon Knight is a character. It's like a knight who comes out under the... I don't know anything about him. I know who Moon Knight is to look at, but I don't really know an awful lot about a story. I've never read the Moon Knight comics, but there is a potential to see Oscar Isaac in the Moon Knight cowl. Whether or not that is exciting probably depends on whether or not you like Moon Knight, but Oscar Isaac is always good. So I'm saying that's a plus.
He is.
Sure.
Yeah, sure.
Sorry, that's sure. Whatever.
Yeah, whatever.
Can't wait to hear you
Did
review
you see
that
the
show.
Nick Frost Sorry. Is keeping busy, isn't he? Because he's going to be the male lead in the next series of Why Women Kill, which we also didn't have time to review on the show, but is on Alibi, still on Alibi in this country, that channel, and is a really interesting anthology about, you know, looking at why women kill. And he plays a 1940s husband with a secret hobby that we don't know what it is. And his wife, played by Alison Tolman, is oblivious, and it's all going to be very dark and interesting.
A secret hobby. Is it World of Warcraft?
Yeah, it's World of Warcraft, yeah. So, but I'm fascinated that Nick Frost does lots of different interesting projects. And, you know, he's just done Truth Seekers, obviously, which we disagreed about last week. And now he's doing this.
Oh, exciting times. Terry, you haven't brought up the Ava DuVernay news, which is quite on brand for you. Why is that?
What Ava DuVernay news, James?
She has cast, because you know she's doing the Colin Kaepernick limited series. Uh-huh. She has cast in the role of young Colin, Jaden Michael, who is actually extremely good in Vampires vs. the Bronx, which is on Netflix recently. And we were talking about that when we talked about it on the Empire podcast. We said, oh, I'm very excited to see what he will do next. And this, Terry, is what he will do next.
Oh, my God.
Good talk. Right.
Ava DuVernay confirmed she's directing at least the first episode, isn't she? I think it was just
yes.
news.
Yes.
That's
news.
Good. That is good news. Also, in other news that Terry will be mega excited about, Netflix are developing a live action Assassin's Creed TV series.
Oh, Christ. Did we not learn from the movie that was what to be the first, was meant to be the first of many movies and remained only the first movie for very good reason?
Yeah, it wasn't the best. It wasn't the best. And I say that as the person who gave it 3 stars. But then think about this, Terry, that the latest Assassin's Creed game is Assassin's Creed Valhalla, which is all about Vikings. So maybe this will be a live action Assassin's Creed Viking show. And that will be,
oh,
there'll
good.
Be Knuts everywhere and it'll be brilliant.
Even better. Good.
Great.
Yeah.
So Apple does what sounds like an exciting new show being worked on for Apple TV Plus called Platonic. So this is Seth Rogen and Rose Byrne, who obviously have been in the Bad Neighbours movies together, are very funny together, have great chemistry. Nick Stoller, who directed the movies, is behind this new show with them. As you guess from the title, Platonic, apparently they're friends with issues. Nick Stoller is working on it with his wife, who's also his creative partner, Francesca Del Banco. And there's a 10-ep order, apparently. But I think they're great together. I think they're dead funny. And I think a couple of these shows really landing for Apple TV Plus, you know, rounding out like The Morning Show and Servant, which we talked about last week, is coming back in January, which we're very, very, very excited by. having a really great comedy with a bit of dram in there. I'm not going to say rom-com, but I think this could be good. I'm excited.
Mm. As you can tell, Boyd and I are equally excited.
Fucking, can we get Assassin's Creed via the way of Vikings? And it's like, you've like literally up to your knees in your own semen. And like, talk about
thanks for that. Thank you so much.
Sorry, yeah. I tried to find a way to say dead excited, wow. And that's all I could come up with on the hop.
That's upsetting.
Wow. Yeah. That is
Christ,
really upsetting.
Let's move on. Narcos Mexico. Narcos Mexico has been renewed for a third season, but it will be without Diego Luna. So he will not be returning for season three.
Why? Is he too busy?
I don't know, to be honest. He hasn't said, but he's not coming back.
Yeah,
so,
he must
you know.
Be. He must be.
That feels like a loss, doesn't it?
It does feel like a loss, yeah. But he does do loads of films and stuff, doesn't he? So.
He does.
Yeah.
He's busy. He's busy. Do you think it's related to his Cassian Andor commitments?
Yeah, probably, right? Because that's still filming.
Yeah, so you would think maybe he doesn't have time to fit in the both of them. So perhaps it's Cassian related. But perhaps not.
Yeah.
Boyd, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, in Treatment, do you know, in the HBO series Treatment, which was Gabriel Byrne, which was great, by the way, back in the day. And when
weird
on
format,
they're reviving
a really
it.
Weird format. Because wasn't it on every single day of the week? And each day was like a different appointment with a different patient. So like you could just watch Tuesdays or just watch Thursdays. Very strange.
Yeah. Well, now they've got, so their cast, Uzo Aduba, who was Crazy Eyes in Orange is the New Black.
Mm, she's great.
And she's going to be the therapist wrestling with her own issues as well as other people's. And there'll be three patients, they're saying. So it'll focus closely on. But I just think it was a really good format and she's brilliant. And I think that's a good idea.
Okay. Well, any other news before we close the book on this? Excellent.
No.
I think Nicole Kidman's doing another show at Amazon. It's an adaptation of a play called Things I Know to Be True by Andrew Bevel. There you go. That's the last bit of news for you.
What's it about? Is it another, like, kind of
It centres on a married couple
crime.
Called Bob and Fran as they watch their adult children make shocking decisions that will change the course of their lives and explores the resilience of an enduring marriage and how familial love can evolve.
Okay. She's loving her TV projects, though, isn't
she? She is. She's having a big old TV time at the moment. Have you watched the final Undoing yet, Boyd, without any spoilers?
No, they haven't sent it.
No, you haven't got it.
I've only got I've got the fifth. Yeah. Have you got it?
No, I haven't. I was just curious.
Oh, I was going to say, yeah. I mean, even though we kind of trashed it, I am really excited to see the ending. I really need to know what fucking happens.
Yeah, no, I can't. I tried to continue watching it this week, but decided to watch The West Wing, obviously. But yeah, I'm definitely going to watch the. I'm definitely going to keep watching it.
I cannot fault your choices.
Even though I don't like it.
Hate watch. I hate watch. Shall we move on to this week's reviews? And we begin, as we should have done last week, but were unable to, with The Mandalorian Season 2, a show that is so fresh, we literally watched it an hour ago as it dropped today, Friday, as we record, as no advanced press screeners were made available. So this is the triumphant return of Pedro Pascal's masked bounty hunter, but more importantly, of Baby Yoda, the cutest critter in the galaxy, as you can see, because Boyd has one. Mando returns after the climactic events at the end of Season 1, but there are more obstacles for him to deal with yet. Now, I will say at this point that Empire Magazine is doing episode by episode spoiler special podcasts of The Mandalorian, and we are in fact recording the first one of those later on today. So we will not have any spoilers in this particular review of The Mandalorian. We will sort of skirt around them. But if you do want us to get really in the weeds about the first episode, and there is a lot to talk about, which we won't be able to on this show, but if you do, then do sign up to the Empire Spoiler Special podcast, which you can subscribe to at glow.fm/empirefilm. And you can hear us every week in your ears talking about all the spoilers from The Mandalorian there. But in the meantime, let's do a spoiler-free review of this first episode. Boyd, is the Force still strong with this one?
Yes. Oh my God. I love this show. I mean, I think I really liked Season 1, and I think it had, you know, it was 8 episodes, and it has a kind of, it does have a kind of procedural story of the week, you know, structure to it. So while the bigger arc is Mando looking after
Baby Yoda, the child, aka the child, the actual character's name. And obviously that's the big story, the overall story. But along the way, he visits different places and basically gets involved with the locals. And there's like a mini crisis or a big crisis, as in this opening episode, for him to help and deal with and grapple with while he then moves on to the next place. So it's a classic TV serial structure, really. But I thought within the confines of that, and perhaps helped by the confines of that, it was so beautifully done. Visually, the way it echoed, you know, the very first Star Wars films, the original trilogy, you know, there are shots that echo the Star Wars itself. The way that beautiful kind of father-son relationship between the Mandalorian and the child is just so cute and sweet and moving, and every reaction shot from Baby Yoda is extraordinary. The expressions they get out of that character are fantastic. The kind of deadpan wit and comedy of the character of the Mandalorian himself, I think, is so brilliantly done. And that, I felt, that was like ratcheted up in this first episode. There's some very funny little moments where he's being incredibly deadpan whilst helping with this challenge that is set when he arrives with Baby Yoda for this next stage of the journey, so to speak. I'm trying not to do any spoilers. So, and I think in this first episode, which was written and directed by Jon Favreau, he did a brilliant job of reminding you of the Western origins of Star Wars itself. There's so many Western vibes going on in this episode, you know, like literally walking into an empty saloon and all of that. And the fact that the Mandalorian himself really is a Clint Eastwood character. You know, people compare him to Jack Reacher, but I think it's more the Clint Eastwood Man with No Name figure of those classic spaghetti Westerns and beyond that reminds me of. And he does absolutely brilliant. Pedro Pascal, just purely in the voice, does a brilliant job with that. The detail, the references, so I think people get worry about how it's going to refer to and fit into the Star Wars universe, and they get quite anxious about it, and with perhaps good reason, considering a lot of people have issues with how the films played out in the end and all of that, and J.J. Abrams. But I think they're doing a really, really good job of making it very fulfilling for fans to see those references and to bring back elements from the original Star Wars films, and yet not go over the top with it, and still retain the premise of this series, which is something in itself is very, very enjoyable, entertaining. And this episode, which is I think the longest episode so far, it's nearly an hour long. I just think it looks incredible. I mean, every episode looks like it costs $200 million, and yet if you watch the making of stuff, they have a brilliant way of filming it using modern technology that makes it not that expensive, apparently, but it looks fucking lush and incredible and epic. In this episode, this isn't a spoiler, but one of the big climactic action scene, it moves aspect ratio from widescreen 2.3.9 to a kind of filling the screen. I thought, so that added, I love an aspect ratio change. That added to the whole excitement.
Maybe
of it
the
as
nerdiest
well.
Thing you've ever I, said, but yes.
Yeah.
Love an aspect I ratio love, change.
I absolutely do. I loved every minute of it. I thought it was phenomenal, and I can't wait to see the rest of it. But this is a high bar. I think they really came back strong. It's just incredibly entertaining. I know that phrase, you know, the tonic we all need in these times, is all those cliches, but it really fucking is the tonic we need in these times.
Terry.
So, you know what? I had this when we reviewed the first season, which is I absolutely loved it and then dropped it like a hot potato, never to pick it up again, as I want to do. And I watched this morning and I just loved every minute of it. And I really wanted then to go back and watch everything that had ever been made in the Star Wars universe ever, because it does have lovely echoes back and lovely bits of granular detail that we're going to absolutely set on fire the mega weirdo geek fans' Hello Jones diet. But also it's totally accessible to somebody who's never seen a Star Wars film at the same time. And I know, I think I said this last time, but it's an extraordinary thing to be able to pull off. I mean, and the way it looks, boy, it's impeccable. The detail in how this world is rendered is just extraordinary. And the ambition in each and every scene, it opens on this, with this set piece that is like it could have been a third act set piece. They open with it and you get another one at the end, which could have been the third act of a movie. Like, there is no skimping on any of it. And they do a lovely job of balancing the violence. Bearing in mind, it is Disney Plus. The violence with these moments of slapstick, that there's something at the beginning where there's these gorgeous moments of physical comedy that really undercut what otherwise may be arguably a little bit too violent. And there's some incredible, I mean, the creatures we've got this time around just look extraordinary. And there's a really interesting flashback, which actually kind of speaks to the narrative that's being served in The Mandalorian, which is you've got the events of Return of the Jedi with the Death Star exploding. But what you've never thought about in Star Wars history is, well, what happens to people on the edges of the galaxy? What happens to people who aren't the kind of main narrative heroes? How does it affect people in those outer reaches? And we see
the outer rim, actually, Terry.
We've seen this in recent Star Wars movies, right? Which is what about the people, the everyday people, the people who are just trying to like get by in life and aren't the big narrative cinematic heroes? And that makes it weirdly interesting for modern times, as does all of the stuff that we know is in there, the tribalism, difference, prejudices, all these themes that have actually been part of Star Wars historically. And then you watch The Mandalorian in the current climate and it feels really incisive and really interesting and really modern. And it is, I mean, this one was 55 minutes, we should say. And obviously we know from season one that they do vary in length. Yeah. I love the fact that they vary them in length depending on what the episodes need. As Boyd said, this is a self-contained, you've got your adventure or challenge of the week or however you want to describe it. And it does have a resolution of kind at the end, even though there's obviously continuing threads which form the entire arc of the season. But I just think that it's the ambition, the scale, the scope, the heart. Baby Yoda is exactly like my son. It's so weird. It's like freaking me out. I just thought this is so beautifully done. And I tell you what you know from watching this. Favreau, holy shit. Is there a man in the universe, apart from you, James Dyer, that loves the Star Wars universe more? The love and affection and tenderness and detail with which he renders this world. And it's really lovely to be in a world created by a man who has so much love and respect and reverence for the source material. I think you feel it in every single scene. I really do.
As Boyd said, Jon Favreau, in fact, directs this episode as well as writes. It's the first time he's directed an episode. And yeah, it's like, I love this. I love the westernness of it. I love the fact that he literally rides into town. And, you know, you've got the sort of the people standing in the doorways of the little houses looking out. And it could be from, you know, any Clint Eastwood film, as Boyd, as you said. You know, it's very, very, very western vibed. My favorite episode, I think, from season one, I really enjoyed, possibly episode two, which was a little one, but it was the silent one with the Jawas. Remember that one with the mudhorn? And I think this one shares a lot of DNA with that one.
Yes.
I loved a lot of when we won't go into the story of it in case you haven't seen it yet, but it is so well done. There's so much money on screen. And I will say there are an incredible number of references, like Star Wars references, pretty fucking niche ones in some cases, but some really, really great references in this episode. Again, I'm not going to go into them here. So listen to the Empire Spoiler Special podcast if you want all of that. But a lot happens and it feels... And it has the texture of, and it has the quality, and it has the sort of lavish production values of a Star Wars movie. And I think there's just something delightful about being able to sit down and watch this, whether you're a Star Wars fan or not. I mean, I have very little patience generally for procedural formats, and not just procedurals, but also shows that tit about and never get on with the main plot. Like you have a lot of sort of quicksand episodes where you're just meandering around, just killing time for a few episodes before you get on with the story that you actually care about. And these are the things that almost annoy me most in television. Yet with The Mandalorian, the kind of adventure of the week stuff is so fucking good, so well conceived and so well executed that it almost doesn't matter. And actually, I think the small dramas, the small individual episode moments are weirdly more compelling than the overall narrative in this, because the overall narrative is he's trying to get the child back to its people. But actually, we don't really want that to happen, because you want the child to hang about. So I'm not at all invested in the overall plot at all. Yeah. I don't even want it to resolve. I just want to see them day to day doing things. And for me, that is extremely unusual. And it's like, it's weirdly, it's almost a moment you have in retrospect when you look at the X-Files, where people always say, oh, the X-Files, you were always waiting for the plot-centric ones, the ones, you know, related to the overall conspiracy. It's like, yeah, okay, that's true, but they were actually the worst episodes. The best ones were the perfectly conceived, individual, standalone, beautiful little constructs that they used to make. And I think the same is true of this. Like, focus on the sort of micro, not the macro. But either way, it is awesome. And as I have said at least five times now, do listen to the Empire Spoiler Special podcast, where we will go into this in excruciating detail. The Mandalorian is, of course, available on Disney Plus as of this podcast going out. Episode 1 is available, and episode 2 will be dropping this Friday. Next up this week.
Serial, week by week.
Yes, week by week. Yes, the week by week, Boyd, which is not better on any level. Although, actually, Boyd, do you know what? For this show, yeah. I think you're absolutely right.
Yes,
because it is more standalone, I think it lends itself much better to this format. I think shows with a very clear through line don't, but this does.
Yeah, and just the deferred gratification is people, you know, to have this treat once a week, every Friday, it's perfect.
Also, Baby Yoda's weaponized cuteness. I think there's only so much of that you can take in one sitting. I don't know if I can. I might sort of like be reduced to a mass on the floor if I had like 8 hours of Baby Yoda in a day. But so anyway, that is on Disney Plus now. Go watch it. Next up this week is The Vow. This is HBO's 9-part documentary about sex cult Nexium, which, apart from using slightly upsetting spelling, also sucked many people, including a number of celebrities, into its cult-like self-help groups. It was later exposed for coercing women into becoming sex slaves and branding them with the initials of the cult's leader, Keith Raniere, as well as those of, and I'm absolutely serious, Chloe from Smallville. Bonkers. But true. Terry, what did you make of this?
So, this is kind of, it's timed with it being back in the news because Keith Raniere, who was the cult leader of Nexium, has been sentenced to 120 years in prison. He was found guilty last year of felony after felony, racketeering, sex trafficking. He'd always claimed that his sexual encounters with his followers were completely consensual. Obviously, that was proven not to be the case. This hit the headlines, though, really, because, as you say, it had these weird links to Hollywood. There was a woman in it who was in Star Wars.
It's fucking Aunt Beru.
But there was Alison Mack from Smallville, and you had these, and that was why it got so much coverage initially, because, you know, it was, they were also, well, Alison Mack ended up striking a plea deal, but were involved in this in the criminal case. And so you've got this incredibly mad, by any stretch of the imagination, this is a bonkers batshit story. And so the interesting thing is how that content pairs with a HBO approach, because this is very much a HBO documentary. And we should talk about the filmmakers behind it, because that is really incredibly relevant in terms of how this documentary runs over the 9 hours. The whole thing's directed by Jehane Nujaim and Kareen Amer, who were behind The Great Hack, which is obviously one of the most talked about and I think credible documentaries of recent years. Now, this is really interesting because you have this mad, explosive, very salacious in many respects, tabloidy story, which is of a sex cult, which is of these Hollywood actresses somehow part of the actual criminality behind it. And what's interesting about the first episode is that in parts it feels incredibly dry. And what I'd say, first of all, is watch past the first episode. Don't give up at the first episode, because what the first episode does is a very good job of showing how you become embroiled in a cult. Because somebody says, you know, it's not like somebody comes up to you and goes, hey, do you want to be part of a cult? Like, that's not how it happens. You become part of something and then you get sucked in and it becomes something else. And I think what this does is it does a really good job of showing how that happens, because initially this is couched as an executive success program, right? And really what it shows is, how do you get from something that is pitched at kind of middle managers? It's like an Instagram self-improvement kind of vibe, which is, it's a very big thing at the moment, which is all about self-improvement. It's about being your best self, the whole world of betterment and individual responsibility for your own success. And so a lot of the messaging, when you first hear them talking about it, and it interviews people who were previously in the cult and who kind of left, but it's also got a huge amount of primary footage. And that primary footage is mainly from kind of these training videos, from videos that were made of them actually running sessions. There's telephone calls they recorded. There's an incredible amount of actual material that shows how they indoctrinated people. So you have these weird videos that are quite low rent. Half the time these sessions are taking place in a bloody local Holiday Inn. And there's something kind of interesting about the kind of ordinariness of what it started out as. And the first episode very clearly plots how they put this program together, the different elements of the program, and how they kind of articulated that to people and used that to get people in. So in the first episode, it very much focuses around Sarah Edmondson and Mark Vicente, who end up becoming two of the kind of leaders. And it's very much their story of how they become involved. And it's only as the episode progresses and you learn more about their stories and you start to see hints about what the cult did to their personal lives, that you feel the more dramatic elements coming in. So Mark, for example, he married a woman, Bonnie, who we talked about from Star Wars, who she was also in this organisation. And clearly it becomes apparent that this caused real problems between them. And once you get to see the more human elements, it becomes super, super, super interesting. So you may feel when you first start watching this that it's a bit dry, it doesn't really go very fast, that it doesn't seem, you've got all these headlines in your mind and it doesn't seem to be anywhere close to what you've probably read about. But it shows how a very basic kind of proposition of self-improvement, that we are going to help you become a better version of you, how that can be the seeds for actually what ends up being incredibly predatory and criminal. And that I find fascinating about it. I found the kind of exposing of that whole scene, which seems very harmless, how that can be used and weaponized against people and allow them to be exploited kind of down the line. So I've watched two episodes of this. Episode two really starts to get into the meat of the stuff we're more familiar with. And it's, you know, it's shot. There is new footage, obviously, of them being interviewed. There's a weird kind of thing where you see like a bit of the back of the interviewer, which kind of threw me at first because I wasn't quite sure what the decision was behind that from a filmmaking perspective. But what I thought this did really well is the amount of primary footage, which often isn't the case. You're often just relying on new interviews and talking head stuff. The amount of audio, the amount of video, and the careful, slow way they plot this. In a world of instant gratification, you may get bored, but stick with it, because all of that groundwork, I think, is essential to understanding where they end up. And I think it's credit to the filmmakers that they take their time and do this carefully, because there is a very different version of this documentary where you've got Smallville sex school and you kind of go all in on those elements and you really ramp it up and you make it super tabloid and you kind of rinse it for every single one of those salacious details you can. This feels to me like a proper attempt to understand how women especially can be exploited through this kind of facade of self-improvement, and how the gender dynamics within that really allow these women to be exploited and these men to be in these positions where they are preying on vulnerable women.
It's very interesting because how you've described this, the slow burn, if you like, of the narrative of this series, because there have been loads of, there are loads of TV documentaries made about the Nexium cult. So there was an Investigation Discovery 2-hour special. There was an E True Hollywood Story, which is very much, as you described, the tabloidy version, which I've actually seen. And that was my first awareness of the Nexium thing, was in an E True Hollywood Story episode, which is jaw-dropping in itself. Stars Play has just put its documentary series, which is a four-parter, and that's on called Seduced, Inside the Nexium Cult. And that is very much focused on Catherine Oxenberg and her daughter, Catherine Oxenberg, the Dynasty actress, and her daughter India, who's involved in the group. And they became estranged. I watched the first episode of that. And if you want the pacey, I wouldn't say exploitative, but if you want the pacey version, that these are the facts, this is the situation, this is why it's a cult, this is why it's a bit like Scientology mixed with about eight other different religious cults over the years, then it's a very interesting kind of sidebar to this series. But equally, I do think this is like this feels like the heavyweight, uncompromising, slow burn version. Very much as you say, kind of the filmmaking is very HBO, down to, you know, the very lavish title sequence and the music and everything. It's very much almost done as a drama miniseries, as in kind of thing. It's already been recommissioned, by the way, for another series, because obviously it's still in the news with Ranieri just being sentenced, as we said, to 120 years. And still, by the way, in contact with many of the women, apparently, from prison. He's communicating still with a lot of the women who were involved with him.
And using mafia-like tactics to reach out as well. Like, it's all a bit sinister.
Right. But I'm obsessed. The bottom line is I'm obsessed with these kinds of cults. I'm obsessed with Scientology. I've probably watched every single documentary and read quite a few of the books about Scientology. I find the whole thing horrifying and terrifying, and I find it, I cannot get my head around how people can fall for these things. And when you see the granular detail, as you do in this HBO series, and as Terry describes, it brilliantly doesn't do the thing that begins with the flashback of, you know, he's being tried. It starts at the very, very, very beginning for these people. And it shows you how, and I was fascinated by the fact that the way in is that they ask you about your fears and phobias, and they cure those phobias. But of course, that's one of the basic elements of psychotherapy and counseling. You can overcome your fear. This Morning does it practically every week. You know, they have therapists on This Morning enabling you to deal with your fears. It's easy. It's not difficult. And yet the people on this first episode who describe how that's what led them in are like, oh my God, I can't believe they managed to help us sort out our fears and phobias. Well, yeah, any trained person knows what they're doing, can do that. But then they're lured in, and it is that luring in process and that slow realization. And they kind of over the scarves that you mentioned, the fact that, you know, this messianic God complex fucking twat, I mean, the least word I could describe him, the leader of it all, and his assistant, and the moronic nonsense that he's coming out with, the fact that they kind of perfectly intelligent filmmakers and actors and people of all walks of life, doctors. Richard Branson goes to one of the fucking retreats, etc. I mean, obviously, you know, he's a doofus. But anyway, people drawn in by this thing, I find it endlessly fascinating. And this series I'm going to watch every single episode because I need to know in every detail. So the HBO one is the detail. I would say if you do want a quick guide to everything, all of it, in put in a context of these cults, because there's a lot of people in the Stars Play version, cult experts, talking about it. I think it's very interesting the links they literally, like, almost like Ranier studied L. Ron Hubbard and Scientology to work out how to fleece people with this bullshit thing that he's created. And it's disturbing and terrifying. But I think the HBO thing, what it does so brilliantly is it does show you the process. And if you're like me and you do find it mystifying how people can be taken in, I think what the HBO series is doing really well is showing you that process and explaining it as much as it ever could.
See, the question I would ask you there, Boyd, is does this need to be 9 hours long? Like, it feels extremely indulgent. Like, I get what they're trying to do. The thing they've got here is they've got incredible access to people and footage. So they have a shit ton of amazing material. And I think because of that, they've gone for this granular, detailed approach to it. But certainly, I mean, and Terry alluded to this, like, I only watched the first episode, but I was properly bored by the end of it. Like, it's so slow. I mean, it's not that it isn't interesting, because it is. And I know a decent amount about this, thanks to Wikipedia. But, you know, it's interesting in the way, as you both said, like how it portrays how easy it is to get sucked into these things, how right-minded people who would describe themselves as skeptical and sort of, you know, resilient to these things were sucked in because it had this veneer of respectability and legitimacy, and that it was a sort of an executive focused self-help group. So you didn't go in thinking, oh, this is the Moonies, it's a crazy cult. You went in thinking, oh, this is like, it, like people get sucked in by that. And then this other thing, the Vow, as they called it, I think there was another name for it as well, this other layer to the group was this weird sex cult where you're having people's initials branded into you. You know, it's kind of nuts. But on the face of it was just a weird self-help group where people were obsessed with getting different colored scarves. Like, it's a really odd thing. So there's a lot to unpack, and it gets more and more insane. And there's so much, you know, that they could have led with that's glossy. And I mean, we've already talked about, you know, Alison Mack, who became not just a part of the superficial thing, but was really involved in the sex cult side of it. I mean, she's awaiting sentencing at the moment. You know, we're not going to get a Smallville reunion anytime soon, I can tell you that. Like, Kristen Crook was involved. There's footage of her in there, but again,
no way your priorities lie.
Yeah, exactly that. But yeah. Kristen Crook was involved in this. But more than that, you know, Boomer, Grace Park from Battlestar Galactica was in there, and Callie from Battlestar Galactica, Nikki Klein, and I had no idea until I read up on this. She leaves Battlestar Galactica. Spoiler, she gets flushed out of an airlock. But she leaves Battlestar Galactica because she broke her contract with the show. She asked to leave so that she could devote herself to Nexium full time. Like, she quit Battlestar Galactica to become deeply embedded in this cult, and is still, for all intents and purposes, a part of it. Like, they do these dancing protests outside the court and outside the prison where Ranieri's held. Like, it is just bonkers. So there's a lot here, but I just can't help feeling that 9 hours is a lot to ask of people's time for this story. I kind of feel, you know, surely this is a really, really solid 3-hour documentary, and maybe that's what I wanted.
I recommend you should watch the Starz Play version, because that's what literally
those
that
are like me with a short attention span, one's the way to go.
Yeah. It's a perfectly good, you know, a series, by the way. But I'm very grateful that I wasn't bored. I think it is a deliberate slow burn, as I say. I keep using that phrase. I think it's a deep dive, and I think all of that is, and I think there is more than enough material for the 9 hours and the second season, by the way, which I mentioned. So it's going to be, in the end, probably 18 hours.
As I said, I've only seen 2 episodes, but I think from what I've seen so far, I understand why the story is going to take as long as it is. And I'm with Boyd. I think that is the way that these stories should be told. This quick fix of, like, you know, oh, it's somebody famous, slap their face on it, get straight into the deep dive, sticky bits of that, and kind of fuck how it all happens. Surely the point of these things is to enable us as a society to talk about how these things can even happen in the first place, and who's vulnerable from these things, and where do they come from in the first place? How do seemingly normal, successful, middle-class people end up in a sex cult where they're fleecing people and trafficking people? I mean, it's absolutely insane, and yet it starts from such ordinary beginnings, and that is what makes it fascinating. And I think that's what justifies the approach they've taken as a document, multi-episode documentary and multi-series, from what Boyd says.
Okay, fine. Well, I probably will not be pressing on with this, but should you wish to, The Vow is arriving on Sky Documentaries on Saturday. Finally, this week, we have His Dark Materials Season 2, the continuation of the BBC's adaptation of the renowned Philip Pullman trilogy. This second season tackles the second book, The Subtle Knife, and continues the adventures of Lyra and Pantalaimon as they explore an alternate reality, only one without J.K. Simmons in this instance. Boyd, you and Terry insisted that my demon would be some kind of patronising giraffe, I seem to recall, from episode 1. So both me and Jerry are here to talk about the show. So what did you and your demons think of season 2?
Do you know what? If I'm honest about His Dark Materials, I think I got very excited about it when it arrived, and I really liked it to begin with. I think there were some issues. I had some issues a little bit with the child acting, to be honest, which is a hard thing when you've got, you know, you've got young characters at the heart of this story. And I thought there was a kind of certain variable quality to some of the acting early on in the first series. And I also think the way they have grappled a little bit with the way the books are huge, big. These are huge, big, sprawling epics. They're quite different, for example, to the Harry Potter books. And I know in the end, you know, J.K. Rowling wrote epic, long Harry Potter books, but they were much more focused, I think, the Harry Potter books in a way. The His Dark Materials books, as I read the first two, were incredible, but they're dealing with huge, big ideas and philosophy and politics and religion, and at the same time have a multitude of characters, a multitude of worlds, and the multiverses, all of that. It's a bigger thing to grapple with and to hone into kind of bites of television, if you like. And I thought Jack Thorne, the writer, did a pretty good job, but it did tail off for me, I have to say, the first series. I think I slightly lost interest a little bit in the middle. I kind of went back to it in the end, but the good news is I've watched the first two episodes of this second season. I think they've really ratcheted it up for me. I think they've done, and it's almost like imperceptible, but I feel like it feels much more confident, bold. I mean, it was always, you know, it was always very lavish and looks great and all of that. But I think in the storytelling and in the kind of detail of it, and I think particularly it helps the fact that you've got in this now Lyra, played by Daphne Keane, who I think she's just improved as an actor, you know, who I just feel like now she's really, really having a good time. And she now bonds with Will Parry, played by Amir Wilson. And now there's these two young people at the centre of the story. And the first episode kind of starts with them getting to know each other and kind of forming a team. And I think that's immediately helping the story kind of bowl along. And at the same time, it cuts between, you know, what's happening in the bigger kind of politics of the universe that it's dealing with. And I think that, you know, in the Magisterium, what's happening there, it's kind of bold and interesting dealing with, you know, the idea of witches and non-believers and people who are investigating outside worlds and kind of challenging the mythology that this kind of, if you like, government of this world, the Magisterium, doesn't want to deal with. And there's loads of stuff about religion and politics that I think is absolutely fascinating and is done really well. And Ruth Wilson, every single scene she's in, she is incredible, magnificent as this kind of manipulative, horrendous Miss Coulter figure. And I think she's phenomenal. And the stuff she does. So this goes out 8 o'clock on a Sunday on BBC One. And it is obviously partly it's a YA, it's for young people. It's, you know, it's for, I think 10, 11, 12 year olds are going to watch this thing. It's quite harsh. There's basically torture going on in the first episode with Ruth Wilson's Miss Coulter. And it's pretty no holds barred, I would say. But I think it has to be that way. I think it's got that confidence that Doctor Who has when it goes really dark, that it will go there and it won't compromise, because Philip Pullman's vision has some pretty weighty, difficult, challenging things to deal with. So I think they're doing a really good job. And I thought episode two was even better than episode one. And we haven't even got to, slight spoiler alert, but it's not really, we haven't even got to the arrival of Andrew Scott's character yet, which I think happens in episode three. And I'm really looking forward to that, because he's going to be magnificent, I'm sure. So I think this feels like a step up to me from series one, and loads of people loved series one. And I think they'll absolutely love series two.
I watched the first couple of episodes, obviously, of season one when we reviewed it, and then never went anywhere near it again.
Because you're you.
I didn't care. I was kind of like, it looks great, it's whatever, but it wasn't for me. It's definitely not a Terry show. So trying to watch season two, episode one, with no knowledge of what happened in season one or any of the episodes after one and two was quite the challenge. So my observations are thus, Daphne Keane, she's good. So I really liked her in, I think she's great. I loved her in Logan. I think she's a phenomenal child actor. I can't remember whether I thought she was good or bad in the first one, probably good. Seems to have nice chemistry with Amir Wilson. Those two kids together. Ruth Wilson is absolutely terrifying and manipulative and hot and incredible. she's just magic whenever she's on screen. But I couldn't really tell you anything that was happening or what was going on or anything about the book it's based on or Jack Thorne's writing or anything. So, yeah.
Wow. Good. That's good. Excellent insight, Terry. Thank you very much for that contribution. I have a confession to make. I didn't watch
you
it.
You watch it.
But I didn't watch it. Deliberately didn't watch it, though. Like, I had no intention of watching it, mainly because it's very much on my list to watch His Dark Materials properly, and I haven't finished season one. So I didn't feel that I could, in good conscience, jump into season two and ruin my enjoyment of the show.
Oh, dear.
So unfortunately, I have refused to watch it in protest because I want to watch it properly. I have read the first two books. One of these things, so that trilogy of books, which are kind of renowned as being amazing, I read when they first came out. I read the first two, and I never read the third one. So at some point, I should probably go back and do that. Oh, you never read the third one?
I did the same thing.
It's kind of a freaky thing. Like, no. Everyone thinks I'm nuts when I say that, because the third one is like the climax.
No, yeah.
But I don't know what happened. I think I maybe just got a bit lost.
Yeah, I cannot believe you haven't literally watched one of the three, only three shows we're doing for personal reasons.
I am the worst.
You played by your own rules.
I didn't even know what the fuck was happening.
Yeah. I mean, you are mad. I am. You're a loser.
Because I was like, I'll get bollocked if I say, why am I watching this when I have no clue what's happening? I'll get bollocked by James.
What the flying... People are going to be like, why isn't James held forth? Yeah. They're not going to notice. James, what did you think?
I'm not cutting any of this. I'm keeping it in.
You're keeping this in?
I'm keeping it in. Yeah, I'm fessing up to it 100%. I did not watch it because I wish to watch it properly all the way through, and I haven't finished season one.
Here's the thing. Why don't you not catch up on some show that came out 10 years ago and watch that every day and watch this thing that we're reviewing this week?
I mean, you make a valid point. That would have been the more professional thing to do, wouldn't it?
Exhausted.
But Counterpart's really good. I don't know what to tell you. Anyway, here's Dark Materials season two hits BBC One this Sunday at 8 o'clock of the PM. So what would our pick of the week be?
Oh, The Mandalorian.
Oh.
Yes.
Yeah, yes. Mandalorian.
I think that's fair.
But The Vow's really good as well, and so is His Dark Materials. There are.
It's a good week. It's the opposite of last week. What else is out this week that we've missed, boys?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a good week. There's bits and pieces. Godfather of Harlem is on Stars Play. Do you know about that? Which uses people who are featured in Ridley Scott's American Gangster film and kind of expands on them, and including Malcolm X pops up. So it's kind of dramatization of what was going on with crime in the 60s. Forest Whitaker's in it. It looks quite a good show. So that is going to be on Stars by Godfather of Harlem. It will be, I think, by the time we come out on Monday. There is, you know what? There is this thing called Trackers on Sky Atlantic and Now TV on Friday, which is based on Dion Mayer's crime novel. I think it's a South African series, but it looks quite kind of big. It looks like a kind of big action gangster thing. Friday, Sky Atlantic. Zach Galifianakis' series Baskets is back on today, Monday on Fox. And Black Monday, which I actually watched some of the first season with Andrew Rannells and lots of good people. That is back on Tuesday on Sky Comedy.
Okay. Good stuff. Okay, let us have a quick Banshee segment before we go. This, of course, if you are new to the podcast, is the section where we look back at old shows that are no longer on and recommend them for you, so named after the Jonathan Tropper show Banshee. I'm gonna be incredibly on brand and say, I can't believe I've never done this before. Someone on Twitter alerted me to the fact I've never done it. Frank Herbert's Dune, which is perhaps the most me thing to ever Banshee. Now, Dune, the film, Denis Villeneuve's Dune, which I was very excited about, has been pushed now a whole year. It won't arrive until Christmas 2021. However, that does not mean that you cannot enjoy some Arrakis goodness in the meantime. By which I mean go back to the year 2000, where this sci-fi miniseries, Frank Herbert's Dune, adapted that first of Frank Herbert's books. And William Hurt is in it, Alec Newman is in it as Paul Atreides, and it is a, let's be honest, modestly budgeted, I think the whole thing cost like $20 million, recreation of that most epic books. I mean, you can't compare this to what Denis Villeneuve is going to do to it. Also, it's 20 years old, so the effects are properly ropey. And they use a really slightly odd thing, like the Fremen in Dune have bright, bright cobalt blue eyes. So instead of using a computer effect, they seem to have given them contact lenses that fluoresce under ultraviolet light. So you just see them with these lenses on. They're obviously waving these ultraviolet lights off screen to make their eyes light up. So it's strange, and it gives them double pupils. It's very, very bizarre. But this, it's actually, like, if you compare this to David Lynch's movie adaptation of Dune, this is a much more faithful retelling of the story. It's actually really good in that it covers off all the detail. You get a lot of the nuance in there. The acting's a bit ropey. The costume design is in places absolutely shocking. And the effects, you do get the sense that it's a bit of a, you know, cardboard studio set some of the time. But generally speaking, it is very, very good. So I kind of would recommend it. I would also recommend, if you enjoy Frank Herbert's Dune, to pick up another one, which is Children of Dune, which was the follow-up series that Sci-Fi did. And this is based on the second and third books, Dune Messiah and Children of Dune. And it tells the complete story of Paul Atreides, these two series back together. But Children of Dune is notable because it has James McAvoy in it as Leto Atreides. So that's kind of a, you know, and Susan Sarandon's in it as well. So it's got some pretty good cast in it. So if you have a tolerance for shitty special effects sci-fi and great stories, I highly recommend Frank Herbert's Dune and Frank Herbert's Children of Dune, neither of which are streaming or available to buy, from what I can gather, anywhere. But they are available on DVD, so you can probably pick those up off Amazon or from any of your secondhand purveyors of entertainment.
I'm going to do one suggested by Michael Jones to me on Twitter, and I was thinking of doing it anyway, and then I checked the spreadsheet because I was thinking I must have mentioned this already. I checked the spreadsheet, and what it turned out was that Tom Ellis, when we had Tom Ellis on, our very special guest for that episode, he banshed it. So that, I feel like I can still banshee it because he might banshee it, but that's fine. And it is, of course, Bob and Rose. And the reason why it's noteworthy now is because this is Russell T. Davies's follow-up, in a way, to Queer as Folk, his six-part series that came out in 2001 on ITV. And it's arrived on BritBox. And that is noteworthy because it's never been available on any streaming service or any, it's never been repeated on any channel since it went out. And Russell T. Davies talked about this on his Instagram, and he was talking about how it hasn't been available all these years, and it's very exciting that it has been. And the reason why it hasn't been available was because of music rights.
Oh, really?
And he was explaining that, yeah, he said it happens a lot, that a lot of that shows, if you think of a classic show, any show that we've banshees that doesn't seem to be around on any streaming service now, it's probably because the music rights weren't sorted out so that you have in perpetuity the rights to those particular songs or whatever that were featured in the original. So what they've done with this Bob and Rose is, it's quite a process. They've gone back and made sure they've taken out any music they don't have the rights to and put in something else. There's even a scene it's all about a gay man played by Alan Davis falling in love with a woman played by Leslie Sharp. And there's a scene in this where there's a football match in the background that they reference to, and they don't have the rights to that football match, and they had to take that out. So they work quite hard on these things. They don't just kind of plonk it on a streaming service and then go, oh, everything's fine. They have to really work hard of it, especially when there's all these rights issues involved. But the bottom line is, this was a brilliant, brilliant series. Bold idea of having the central character of a gay man who falls in love with a woman, and he's not supposed to be bisexual or anything. He identifies as a gay man, and Leslie Sharp and Alan Davis are brilliant in it. Jessica Hines is in it. Katie Kavanagh's in it. Penelope Wilton's in it. It's got a brilliant cast. It ends up dealing with political activism in a way, which I think is the theme that goes through all of Russell T. Davies's work right up until his new thing that's coming soon. It's just got his unmistakable wit and narrative drive, and it's great, and it's really exciting that it's back on BritBox. So if you've got BritBox, this is a very, very good reason to get it if you haven't got it already.
Noted. Terry?
I want to do Cardinal Burns.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Yes! James, let me preface this by saying you will hate every minute. This is a sketch show that ran 2012 to 2014. Interestingly, the pilot went out on BBC Three, but then it actually moved to E4 and Channel 4 for its proper
that
series.
That is
commission.
Interesting.
Yes, two seasons. Seb Cardinal and Dustin Demery Burns, pair of comedians. They also did it as a touring show. So this is also, you've got to remember when this was kind of, you know, final days of Loaded and maybe kind of lad culture, and it kind of spoofs that lad culture, but also I think the beginning of the reality scene and anybody being a celeb, that notion of what celebrity is, who can be famous, is all kind of in there, because there's stuff like a spoof interview show called I Know Your Name, where they quiz basically a nobody, like they're a glamorous successful, famous celebrity, which actually could be on any show seriously these days. And some of it's really, really fucking stupid and daft. But I quite like it. There's one where there's like two city boys who basically jump into a rope skipping competition, which doesn't like sound funny, but it is. There's these boy band members who have like a penis on their face for no apparent reason. There's a whole Royal Mail sketch where it's like the Crystal Maze back in there trying to get a package. So it's not like the observations are always like necessarily that original. Even, but there's something so wantonly, ridiculously daft about some of it that I really enjoy. And the tone is kind of goes a little bit dark sometimes. So, and some of these are definitely more miss than hit than miss. Yeah, some of them are definitely more miss than hit. And the ensemble cast had people like Bridget Christie, Aisling B. So there was a whole kind of British comedy crew around this, and it kind of, I think it got named one of the Guardian's kind of funniest British comedies. I think it was nominated for a BAFTA, but it only lasted for two seasons. Those two seasons are on for OD if you want to go and check it out.
Is 4OD the same as All Four?
It's all four.
It's all on four.
I think you'll find it's all four.
I think you'll find.
Yes.
But I loved Cardinal Burns as well. Yeah, it was great. It was brilliant. Yeah. Do you remember Seb Cardinal was in Sally Forever? Do you remember?
And
and I said it was Dustin Demery Burns on this podcast, and he DM'd me on Twitter to say actually it was me. I got the wrong one. But they're both fucking brilliant. Yeah, absolutely fantastic.
And that is it for another episode of the Pilot TV podcast. If you're American and you voted to give Trump a second term, then please head over to Apple Podcasts and make amends by giving us a 5-star rating. Then sit down in a corner and have a good long think about what it is you've done. If you wish to follow us on social media, I am at James C. Dyer. Terry is Terry_White. And Boyd is at Boyd Hilton. We'll be back next week with the new season of The Crown, as we mentioned earlier. And yes, I do realise that I said last week that we'd be doing it in today's show, but you can all blame Boyd for that because I got the date wrong and he didn't correct me. See you next week. Pilot out.